Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two. Gilmore on a big step. Oh, brother.
Lead Toledo Ernest. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at harborparoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and joining me, subbing for Rich again, is Adam Cribbley. Adam, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So we're going to talk about the longest playoff droughts in NBA history. Interesting topic. Especially if you're a Clippers fan or a Kings fan or a Warriors fan, you might not want to listen to this one. I don't want to drive anybody away, but we're going to talk about some bad times for you here.
It does get a little depressing for those fans.
Yes, but so we'll start at the top. The bottom of the top, so to speak, or top of the bottom, whatever it is. The Braves and Clippers franchise, 15 straight seasons from 1977-1991, they missed the playoffs. It started with the Braves being sold to John Y. Brown, who was the Kentucky Colonels owner, but had moved on to the NBA. He sold Moses Malone and Bob McAdoo right away to help defray costs. And then essentially swap franchises with the Celtics owner, and the Braves ended up abandoning Buffalo, moving on to sunny San Diego. A lot of instability there, and like I said, talent sell off because of of cheapness or what have you, and then it was sold to Donald Sterling, and things did not necessarily get much better.
No, they didn't improve after it went to Sterling, and so there was a lot of just questions about the franchise even before this streak started. So as early as 73 or 74, there was talk that the Braves would move to Toronto, and then John Y. Brown was actually when he bought the Braves, he was eyeing a run for the governorship in Kentucky, which he eventually became the governor of Kentucky. So not surprisingly, he wanted to move the Braves to Louisville, and ultimately. He made out in this, so he flips the Braves for the Celtics and gets to lead the Celtics, and then the Braves end up, as you mentioned, in San Diego and then in LA with Donald Sterling. So John Y. Brown definitely got the best of that deal.
He certainly did. They don't call him getting the best of the deal Brown for nothing.
That's right.
So key reasons why the streak continued for as long as it did. Obviously, Donald Sterling being a terrible owner, not to mention a terrible human being, didn't help. Bad owners are going to be a reason for a lot of these. They also traded a lot of draft picks and young players. The pick that eventually became Charles Barkley, Byron Scott, Terry Cummings, Tom Chambers, Ricky Pierce, and Hersey Hawkins. For guys who were like fading veterans like Norm Nixon, Marcus Johnson, or other deals that went bad, they also drafted exceptionally poorly. Lancaster Gordon at number 8 overall in 1984, which is of course one of the great drafters of all time. Benoit Benjamin at number 3 in 1985, Danny Ferry at number 2 in 1989, and Bo Kimble at number 8 in 1990, being among the worst. The lowest point was a 12-70 in 1987. Just kind of a Just kind of a bad year all along, although it did include future Atlanta Hawks coaches Larry Drew and Mike Woodson. So anytime I can get the 2004-2005 Hawks coach mentioned in this podcast, I'm definitely going to take advantage of that, as you know.
Yeah, it's important to fit that in.
Yes. The closest claw they made to the playoffs was 43-39 in the 1979 season, the first year in San Diego. They'd roll be free in there. They would have made it in the playoffs if they had actually, I guess if they'd stayed in Buffalo and been in the East, they would have made the playoffs. So it's a shame on them for moving.
Yeah, it didn't work out well for them.
No. The longest suffering player was Benoit Benjamin, 402 games from 1986 to 1991. He was actually traded the year before they broke the streak. The best player during this drought, I would say, was Sven Nader, who played from 78 to 83. I didn't really include Bill Walton because he was pretty much too beset by injuries to be considered for this.
And if you look at Walton, though, he also, that signing gutted the team. So at the time, they were, the NBA was under a system where if you signed a free agent, you had to give up compensation. And so the Clippers signed Walton as, you know, this huge headliner. Then they had to give up three or four really good players and left Walton kind of stranded. And then he was hurt. So, yeah, Walton really doesn't help them in a lot of ways here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously not at fault for any of that. But yeah, I mean, that's dealt with in the breaks of the game.
Sure.
You know, and yeah, I mean, obviously people are pretty familiar with that, the fact that he missed a lot of games. But I mean, he missed three complete seasons out of four and then played only 14 games in the 1980 season for the Clippers. Then he came back and played a couple of partial seasons for the Clippers and then one close to full season before moving on to Boston. And then, and of course in 86 playing a basically full season and leading them to a championship. So yeah, it was not, it was unfortunately for the Clippers. Yeah. And I get, you know, I didn't really mention that on the key reasons why it continued, but Bill Walton having all those injuries was a pretty key reason. You know, I'm sure they would have made the playoffs at least during one of those seasons. I mean, they always kind of had, you know, up until the, you know, really the later 80s. In the early 80s, they always generally, you know, most of those years had a generally like a decent collection of talent. It was just like guys who didn't fit, or it was just too many new pieces, or, you know, it, or injury here or there. I mean, it, you know, it wasn't like they were always bereft of talent, it was more later in the decade when they just became consistently terrible and awful almost every season.
Sure. Yeah. Early in the decade, they were decent, but they didn't really reach the depths until kind of the mid to late 80s.
Yeah. They were bad in 82, but other than that, yeah.
Sure.
You know, like I said, it ended, they hired Larry Brown midway through the 92 season, finished 23-12. They were led by Danny Manning and Ron Harper. They also had Doc Rivers, Charles Smith, and James Edwards. I guess the what seemed like a low point but ended up actually working out pretty well was Danny Ferry, the number two pick in 89, ended up refusing to play for the Clippers, held out, eventually forced a trade to Cleveland, and they got Ron Harper out of the deal, who, you know, as I mentioned, led them to the postseason, was a pretty good player for him for them before suffering a serious injury and then later kind of reinventing himself with the Bulls. So yeah, that was kind of like a, you know, number two pick not wanting to play for your team, generally kind of a low point, but it actually ended up working out okay.
Yeah, Danny Ferry, I don't think would have been a savior of the Clippers franchise there either.
Probably not. No. Although he was hyped at the time, people definitely were. Yeah, people were definitely into him. So the next longest streak, the Golden State Warriors from 1995 through 2006, 12 seasons. That started when they ended up, Chris Webber and Don Nelson ended up feuding. The team sided with Don Nelson. Chris Webber was traded away after his rookie season, and then they ended up firing Don Nelson not that long afterward anyway. So not a great decision there. They also traded away the franchise stalwarts, Tim Hardaway and Chris Mullin, over the next couple of seasons, and then they embarked on a rebuilding plan. Chris Cohen, it was the owner of the team, another considered one of the worst owners in professional sports, just made a lot of bad decisions when it came to hiring GMs, drafts, coaches. It was all pretty much screwed up. The draft history, Joe Smith at number one in 1995 in the Kevin Garnett draft, trading Vince Carter for Anton Jameson in 98. Jameson, sort of a very good player, and even played well for the Warriors, but Carter clearly the better player. Drafting Todd Fuller, Adonna Foyle, and Michael Petras in the lottery. Losing Gilbert Arenas after two seasons after having picked him in the second round. And even guys who were pretty big hits, like Jason Richardson and Mike Dunleavy, didn't necessarily, those are fifth and third picks overall, didn't necessarily achieve quite to those levels, at least, what you would potentially want out of that level, especially Dunleavy at number three. So,
well, the one that really stands out to me is the Todd Fuller pick. So they took Todd Fuller at number 11 overall in 1996. And even at the time, I was an NBA fan, but I wasn't a super fan at the time. And even at the time, I questioned it that they took a 6'11 kind of, decent college center, number 11. And, of course, hindsight 2020, if you look, Todd Fuller is drafted number 11. And then number 13 is Kobe Bryant. 14 is Peja Stojakovic. And 15 is Steve Nash. So, obviously the Warriors were in position to draft either of them, and they went with Todd Fuller. So it just kind of typifies the decision making that was rampant in Warriors land in the 90s.
Yes, not so good. And speaking of bad decisions, probably the lowest point for the team, I would say certainly the lowest point for the team, 1936 in 1998. They actually had worse win-loss seasons during the stretch, but this was the season in which Latrell Spiro was suspended most of the year after choking his coach, B.J. Carlissimo, who had reportedly been berating him. This really maybe a little bit forgotten about now, but this absolutely got like huge national attention. I mean, it kind of fed into some stereotypes about the league and about African-American athletes that were highly negative, and that definitely rough time for the league and a rough situation, and unfortunately spread some ugliness.
Well, it was one that I think a lot of us don't think a lot about now, because since then we've had obviously other major issues with player conduct and that sort of thing. But it got a lot of mainstream attention, and the fact that it's an African American player and a white coach, as well as the fact that Latrell Sprewell kind of fit every stereotype, or every negative stereotype, I should say, that the NBA struggled with in the late 90s, and that its players were cornrows in their hair and kind of were outspoken and not respected of authority. It fed into all of that. And so it got a lot of media attention, though, like you said, it's not thought of a lot today.
Yeah, and it was a very anti-authoritarian kind of time in the culture.
Sure.
I mean, that was kind of definitely like there's a big thread of that in popular culture, and I mean there is to a lot of times in a certain extent, but I think that was really kind of a peak time for that as well. So it just kind of fed into a lot of things that were going on in society and reflected in that. But in better times for Sprewell, the Warriors came close to the playoffs in 1996, were 36 and 46 that year, relatively close to the playoffs, but finished ninth in the conference. They led by Sprewell and Joe Smith, coached by Rick Adelman, who was definitely the best coach that they had during that time. Their longest suffering player was Adonna Foyle, who played 593 games from 1998 to 2006. He did actually play 6 minutes during the 2007 playoff run, so he made it during that time. The best player, I would say, during for the Warriors during this time was either Anton Jameson or Jason Richardson. I would lean toward Richardson just because I associated him a little bit more with the Warriors, but you could go either way.
Yeah, and he was it? he was with the Warriors when he won the slam dunk title, right?
Yes, yes, he was. So
yeah, so I mean, I think that feeds into it too. Is he had a lot more popular press with that, and like you said, Anton Jameson, I think of more with Washington than with Golden State. No, Jason Richardson is definitely the best player in this era for me.
Yeah, I would say so. And then they ended up breaking the streak in dramatic fashion. They made the playoffs in 2007. They upset the number one seed, 67-win Dallas Mavericks, fueled by Baron Davis, and they got a midseason trade that shook up the team for Al Harrington, Stephen Jackson. They actually finished the last like 20-25 games of the season on a pretty good tear. Actually, I think I performed Dallas during that time as well. So people kind of saw the upset coming, because they also had I think the Warriors had beaten them four times that during that season as well. So it was just sort of a weird situation. It was the first time that a number eight seed beat a number one seed in a seven game series. It had happened in a five game series, but not in a seven game series. So exciting stuff. The Warriors actually won 48 games the next season, but they missed the playoffs just because the West was really tough that year. And then they missed the next four seasons before the Stephen Curry era got in a full swing. And the, you know, whatever the pain the Warriors feel for these years, it certainly, you know, I think they're feeling pretty good right now.
Yeah, I'd say they've gotten over the 12-year drought.
Yes. So next, 11 years for the Timberwolves from 2005 to 2015. And in fact, it could be 12 years if they miss the playoffs this season, which is a definite possibility. It started really just years of bad management from, you know, they got a superstar in Kevin Garnett in 95, and then just had a hard time building around him. Made the Joe Smith thing, where they lost draft picks, and a lot of other things that where they didn't really build other stars around him, or just had a tough time building stars around him. Finally, the guys who were pretty good got old, and they decided to trade Garnett in summer 2007. And then, unfortunately, a key reason why it happened was Kahn would be the number one reason. David Kahn, the general manager who drafted Johnny Flynn and Ricky Rubio back-to-back when they could have had Steph Curry, called Darko Milicic manna from heaven, if I can say those words.
Easy for you to say.
Exactly. Kurt Rambis as a coach, drafting Wesley Johnson, Derek Williams, picking up trying to make it work with Michael Beasley. Although a couple of those were defensible at the time, but definitely worked out poorly. And a lot of mistakes during that time.
You know, I was surprised that Derek Williams and Michael Beasley, neither one really panned out, because when they came out of college, actually at the time I remember thinking that, you know, the Bulls were so stupid for taking Rose when they could have had Beasley, and that, you know, the Cavs missed on Williams and instead took Kyrie Irving. So it's I was very Kahn-esque in my talent evaluation, but I thought for sure Williams and Beasley were going to be, you know, 20-25 point a game scorers with long careers, just because they were studs in college. And then not so much in the NBA.
No, yeah, Beasley especially seemed like I think the talent was a little bit more there for Beasley. It was more just like the lack of maturity and the unwillingness to kind of fit a role. I mean, Williams, I just think it's more of a lacking a position, or you know, it's not as much of an effort attitude thing for him.
When they got Williams, it just didn't make sense either, because they had Kevin Love. And so Williams actually fit better as maybe a, you know, he wasn't a stretch four, but he could play a small ball four a little bit. Right. I don't know, you know, Draymond Green-esque as far as size, different athlete completely, but the idea he could play a small ball four.
Like Draymond Green who can't pass, I guess, would be.
Exactly, right. Or play defense.
Or shoot, but otherwise, yes.
But I mean, as far as like an athletic, you know, a shorter athletic guy, Williams could be that guy, but he didn't get the time under with Kevin Love in front of him. And then he just wasn't as good as I thought he was going to be.
I don't think it was going to work for him, but it definitely was not a good situation for him either. So, and I guess he's been okay in New York. So, So good for him there. The lowest point would be 2010, 15-67, the first year under Kurt Rambis. Kevin Love coming off the bench, and despite clearly being the best player on that team. Their closest call to the playoffs was 2014, where they were 40-42. They had an expected win-loss percentage of 48-34. They've just really had some really bad performances in close games, especially late in games. It was kind of a weird team because it was kind of getting clear that Love was leaving the team, and there was a lot of pressure to be good, but they just, couldn't pull it off. They actually were 44-38 in 2005, which was the last season with Sam Cassell, Latrell Sprewell, and Flip Saunders as the coach before he came back later as coach and GM after the David Kahn era. Longest-suffering player was Kevin Love, who played 364 games. Corey Brewer, very close to that mark. The best player was either be Kevin Garnett or Kevin Love. I mean, Garnett clearly the better career player, but it didn't have as long of a stint with the Wolves during this period as Kevin Love did. So, and they haven't broken it yet, but getting Andrew Wiggins and Karl-Anthony Towns will probably help.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and Anthony Bennett, of course.
Right, of course, the third number one overall pick that they had on their roster for a short time.
Yes, indeed. So what do we have next?
Well, the Sacramento Kings had a couple runs of pretty some pretty trying times, and they had a stretch of 10 seasons beginning in 1987 and lasting until 1996, and the Kings had. They had the coaching carousel that other franchises struggled with. They had, six head coaches in that 10-year stretch. But I think the Kings also had a really, really a rash of really bad luck. So they had this really interesting situation in that in drafts that tended to be weak and not have a lot of talent, they had high picks. And in drafts that were much stronger, they drafted in the 7 or 8 range. And so in 1987... David Robinson went number one, Scottie Pippen went number five, and the Kings picked sixth. And they took Kenny Smith, who was a serviceable player. When they did have the number one overall pick in 1989, they took Purvis Ellison. It was a weak draft, but anytime you're picking up a franchise center and his nickname is Never Nervous, it's not, doesn't bode well for the franchise. And so then again in 1990, with Gary Payton going number two behind Derek Coleman, the Kings drafted seventh. And on, maybe the most glaring example was in 1992 and in 1993, the Kings drafted seventh in both seasons in two really strong drafts. 1992, of course, Shaq goes one and Alonzo Mourning two. And then in 93, Chris Webber went number one and Penny Hardaway went third. And the Kings came out of those drafts with Walt Williams and Bobby Hurley, who I loved personally, as a kid growing up, but neither really were franchise changing. So the Kings really, really struggled with that kind of combination of high picks and weak drafts and low picks, picking seventh or eighth in strong drafts.
Yeah. What's interesting about the Kings during this time is they were actually under 500 for 15 straight seasons from 84 to 98. They made the playoffs three times, and during the 10 seasons in which they did not make the playoffs, they never won fewer than 23 games. So they were never like really, really awful sink to the depths. They were just merely bad to really bad during that time.
Yeah, they managed to avoid being, avoid getting in the playoffs, but also avoid finishing poorly enough to get a high pick, except when, Never Nervous Purvis was on the board, and you can't pass on Never Nervous Purvis.
You can't pass on Purvis. That's just the number one rule of, yeah, I mean, they were 27-55 that year, so they weren't, that is not usually the type of record that will get you number one pick. Yeah, they, by then, the draft lottery, of course, was in, so they won it that year, but yeah, it's a darn shame.
Well, if you look at their low point, that's probably not even their low point. In 87-88, they went 24-58, but you know, maybe more depressingly, it was a short-lived run for Bill Russell. So Bill Russell came back to coaching after taking some time off, and he lasted, you know, 58 games, left midway through the season, and never coached again. He remained in the front office in Sacramento for a bit, but he never coached again. And so Russell kind of has a kind of sad ending to his coaching career in Sacramento in 87, 88.
Yeah, he stayed on as an executive for another year, I think. But yes, it. I think the game might have passed him by at that point. So, yeah. Not ideal. But yes, it is sort of sad that that's the way that he left the game. He was better as a coach in his Seattle years, and of course, you know, as player coach of the Celtics as well. But it is kind of weird that Bill Russell is associated with other franchises other than the Celtics. It just seems like kind of wrong, you know.
Right. No, he shouldn't have, you know, he definitely shouldn't have gone to Sacramento at that point. It, like you said, the game had passed him by, and he was, although I guess if you look at their roster, when you rely on, you know, your best player by far is Otis Thorpe, who was, you know, best known as kind of the third or fourth wheel on the mid 90s Houston Rockets teams. When Otis Thorpe's by far your best player, probably have some issues with roster makeup too. So,
yeah.
Thorpe averaged, went for 20 points and 10 boards a game and had 8.1 win shares. But after the season, he was traded away. And, soon after the Kings rebuild around their awful draft pick. So yeah, it was a low point, but it was a pretty sustained low point. It was, a lot of seasons of, you know, not the worst team in the league, but not threatening the playoffs.
Absolutely. Longest suffering would be Wayman Tisdale at 370 games. Lionel Simmons also was very close behind him.
And so Wayman Tisdale actually came over in a good trade. I'm an Indiana Pacers fan, and so it was not a good trade for Pacers fans, but Tisdale came over from the Pacers in a good trade. And he's, you know, if you look at the best player in this stretch, he's probably their second best player in this drought, but their best player by far is Mitch Richmond. And so Mitch Richmond came over from Golden State in a trade for Billy Owens. The Kings drafted Owens third overall and then traded him, I think before he even played a game for them, over to Golden State. And so Richmond was their only All-Star in this drought. He made the All-Star game four times, and he was a, you know, multi-time All-NBA player, and he was easily their star in this drought.
Yeah, future Hall of Famer. I mean, one of the best players to pretty much always play for a bad team. I mean, he did end up with the Lakers later on in his career, but yeah, not a quite a talent. Yeah, that was not a good trade for Golden State. That was a bad decision.
Yeah, and again, I was a Billy Owens fan, of course. So
there you go.
Again,
you have a knack for enjoying bad basketball players.
I did now.
Yeah.
Now Billy Owens had some knee injuries, I think, but no, I do. I have a knack. It's this love for the 6'7" to 6'9" kind of tweeners, I guess that must be attractive. But
there you go. Yeah.
When they finally, when the Kings finally broke their streak, they kind of did it with a whimper. So they broke their streak with a record of 36-46 and snuck into the playoffs despite being, you know, five games under 500. And really they were still pretty bad that season. It was the expansion season, so the Toronto Raptors and Vancouver Grizzlies were new that season, and they could only split their series against the Grizzlies. They went 2-2, giving the Grizzlies two of their 15 wins that year. So again, though, they broke it because of Mitch Richmond. Richmond was third team All NBA that season and was in the top 10 in pretty much every offensive category, including scoring and free throws and threes and everything. But then after making the playoffs in 96, they promptly missed out again in 97 and 8. And then soon afterwards, they traded Mitch Richmond for Chris Webber and then started making their run in the early 2000s, kind of with their core of Chris Webber and Vlade Divac and Peja Stojakovic. So Yeah, they kind of, you know, broke the streak for a short time, and then really built those improved squads that we all fondly remember from the early 2000s.
So next we have the Dallas Mavericks from 1991 to 2000, 10 seasons. They decided to rebuild in the early 90s after their kind of promising late 80s team sputtered out. Roy Tarpley had drug issues, they traded away Mark McGuire for an aging Adrian Dantley, and you know, other issues. They lost Detlef Schrempf, you know, et cetera. So by early 90s, they had kind of sputtered, and the rebuilding plan actually went okay. I mean, they drafted Jim Jackson and Jamal Mashburn and Jason Kidd in consecutive years. Looked like they were going to, you know, put together a pretty decent team. And then Mashburn got hurt. Jason Kidd and Jim Jackson had a feud, and all were quickly traded within about a year of each other. So not a good situation there. It may or may not have involved Tony Braxton. but
yeah, there's some controversy about that. Jamal Mashburn actually just came out and gave an interview about a year ago and said it was, you know, Tony Braxton, that's kind of overblown, but there's, you know, when there's smoke, there's fire. And I think that that there were definitely, I mean, you're talking about three young, you know, high draft picks that were all at least at the time, destined to be superstars. And so there were some egos clashing. And I you know, whether it was Tony Braxton or not, there was definitely more than just on court problems in Dallas at that point.
Absolutely. So the lowest point would be 1993, where they began the season 4-57 during, and Jim Jackson was the rookie, but he held out most of the season. Finally came along near the end. They finished 7-14 to avoid complete infamy, winning 11 games for the year. They also started off 3-40 in 1994 after you know, they'd gotten Jamal Mashburn. They ended up with slightly more wins, 13 wins that year. So I believe that is the worst two season stretch of all time. I believe those Mavericks have the worst SRS in history of negative 14.6. So yeah, so that is that was a bad team. And actually the year that Jim Jackson was a rookie, I saw him in a hotel elevator in Boston. I took a trip with my mom to Boston, and I'd just gone swimming, and I went to an elevator with my mom, and there were a bunch of tall guys, and I recognized Jim Jackson.
Nice. Did he so he was holding out. He wasn't injured at that point.
No. Yeah, he held out. I mean, by then he has just started playing. So he had played a few games, and they were playing in Boston that time. So yeah, he wasn't hurt that year. He held out for most of the year, and then they came to a contract agreement, you know, whenever, you know, with the last month of the season or so, you know, to play. So
gotcha.
Yeah, but yes, so it was he's one of the first famous people.
Your brush with fame.
Yeah, I was a big Ohio State fan living in Columbus.
Oh yeah.
It was really exciting for me. And so yeah, so I was adoring
those. Those are some great Ohio State teams. I remember, you know, being in tears basically when Jimmy Jackson hurt his he hurt a knee or ankle or something. I just remember him being in a boot and having to watch from the sidelines. But now those are some good Ohio State teams as well. And he was, yeah, he was a superstar. And actually he ended up having a pretty good, and in fact, you know, Kidd was the best of the three, but Mashburn and Jackson, they all had good careers. None of them were busts. They didn't work together in Dallas.
Yeah, I mean, Mashburn got hurt. Jackson kind of just had a weird, like, he kept getting traded all the time, mm-hmm. For whatever reason. Like, he played for like 12 teams, but yeah, I mean, they were 36-46 that first year of the three Js, and people thought it, you know, like I said, it had the potential to be, you know, a great young core, but whatever reason, it didn't go so well. The longest suffering player was Derek Harper, who played in 307 games. Jim Jackson was very close to that mark. The best player during that time was actually Michael Finley, who was there from 97 to 2000. You could also argue Jason Kidd, but he didn't last quite as long there. And he was not as dysfunctional as Michael Finley. Or he was more dysfunctional than Michael Finley. Michael Finley was, as far as I know, not dysfunctional. And, in fact, helped lead them into the promised land once Dirk Nowitzki emerged along with Steve Nash. Don Nelson became the coach and Mark Cuban became the owner. And then they broke into the playoffs and then became, you know, perennial, a very good team. And of course, eventually won that championship. So a couple highlights of or depending on how you want to define it, is that AC Green broke his consecutive game streak for the Mavericks during this time. And then Roy Tarp later returned from his drug suspension in 94-95 after missing two or three straight seasons, I think three, but then unfortunately was banned again from the league soon after. So yeah, that's about it for the unless you have anything else regarding that Mavericks team.
No, that about covers it. It was a pretty dark time for Mavs fans there for a bit.
Yes, it was. So yeah, they've won a championship since. So I feel like if you win a championship afterward, like the memories of that are not nearly as painful. So
it erases it. Yeah.
Yeah, because it led to, and you, I mean, you can argue, you know, the pain of the Mavericks, you know, having to rebuild and then that falling apart and having to rebuild again, it did lead to a, you know, led to Dirk and it led to excellent things. So, you know, that,
sure,
that pain was worth it, I guess you could say. So, next we have the Kings appear again, unfortunately. They 2007 through 15, 9 in a row, it could go to 10 if they miss the playoffs this year. They're doing all right, but definitely it's missing playoffs is a strong possibility. And it started with the breakup of the early 2000 teams that we talked about before, you know, Divac, Weber, Stojakovic. I mean, those guys got older and the ownership, the Maloof brothers, basically lost most of their money and couldn't really afford to run the team. They ran out of shoestring budget. Team nearly moved to Seattle, or moved to a group that, or was going to sold to a group that wanted to move it to Seattle, but they managed to keep it locally, which we'll get back to in a moment. Drafting was a problem. Lottery picks on Spencer Hawes, Jason Thompson, Jimmer Fredette, Thomas Robinson, Ben Lacklamore, and Nick Stauskas. Spencer Hawes has been, and Jason Thompson have been okay players, but the other ones have been bust for the most part. One strong draft pick, Tyreek Evans, who had a really strong rookie season, didn't quite emerge as expected. And Boogie Cousins has a lot of talent, but has had issues with maturity and getting along with teammates and coaches, clashing with most of his coaches, in fact, who have, for the most part, have not been stellar since Rick Adelman left more than 10 years ago. Since those years, in recent years, they've had their new owner, Vivek Ranadive, and he basically has been known as an incredible meddler, and the Kings have lacked stability in their front office for the last 2 or 3 years, and in their coaching, and, you know, people listening to this, these are recent history, so we don't need to go through every move, but it has not been stellar.
No, I think that that the end of the playoff drought, you know, might be this year, but I think more likely it's going to be extended.
Yeah, they're close enough where it's hard to tell.
Sure.
They might still have some moves in them as well. So, and I would say the lowest point, of course, almost leaving town, the NBA Board of Governors voting to keep them in Sacramento and going with ending up selling the ownership of the team there and getting a new arena, all that good stuff. So that all worked out pretty well, but it was looking bad for a while. The closest call to the playoffs was 2008, where they finished 38-44. It was the final year of Ron Artest in Sacramento. Also, Mike Bibby being traded that year. He was the last of that classic Kings era to be traded. I guess Brad Miller kept on for a little bit, a while longer as well. Longest suffering player would be Jason Thompson, who played 514 games. And the best player would, I would almost certainly be DeMarcus Cousins. Although advanced metrics really like Kevin Martin. More than, I mean, I remember that they kind of did, but he actually has more win shares than DeMarcus for their time with the Kings, which I thought was interesting. Not that I would agree that Kevin Martin is a better player, but it was just interesting reminder of like, oh, Kevin Martin was really effective scorer for a while.
He was. No, he was he was a very good scorer. And like you said, the advanced metrics love him, but I think you're right. I think Boogie Cousins is definitely the best player there.
Also, I do think that Cousins took a couple years to really, you know, like his last two seasons, he's been really, really good. Before then, you know, there were issues with defense and there were issues just you know, the shooting efficiency wasn't very good. So it's sure. taken him a little while to round into the player that he's become. But even before then, I don't know if I would have taken Martin over him. But, you know, there's context there that's important.
Right.
Anything else regarding these Kings?
Not really. You know, it'll be interesting to, you know, when we redo this podcast in 5 years where they're at on the list.
Yeah, there you go. Hopefully not at 15 in a row, because that would not make me happy.
No.
I don't like it to see anybody in pain.
No, except Clippers fans. But
you know, oh no, I don't have a problem with Clippers fans. I hope everyone is happy.
That's right. So up next we've got the Utah Jazz, or sorry, the New Orleans / Utah Jazz, who started out their franchise with 9 straight seasons not making the playoffs, and they got off to a really bad start. You know, in hindsight, they were. New Orleans was awarded an expansion franchise in 1974, and one thing the ownership group wanted to do was to make a big splash, to try to attract people to come to watch games for this New Orleans team. So before they had a coach or any players or even a mascot or a nickname, they traded 7 players for Pete Maravich. So there were, 2 players – 2 number 1 draft picks and 3 number 2 draft picks. So among the number 1 draft picks they gave up was David Thompson, who never signed with Atlanta, but regardless was part of the trade. And one of the second round picks was Alex English. And so 7 players netted them Pete Maravich. And then they figured out a coach and other players and a mascot, and eventually, you know, decided on the New Orleans Jazz. But the Jazz were kind of infamous in the late 70s and early 80s just for trading away all their first round draft picks. And so 1975 is their first, 1974 is their first draft pick as a franchise, but they didn't take their own first round draft pick until 1981. So for the first 8 years of their franchise, they either didn't have a first round pick or they swapped picks or whatever. So they kind of fit that model of trying to trade away, you know, as you mentioned with the Clippers, trading away young players and draft picks and trying to instantly be good. So before they played a game, they had traded away, 2 number ones for Pete Maravich and another number one pick for Neil Walk, who was to be their franchise cornerstone center, but is really now best known as the guy who was drafted after Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in 1970.
Yeah. It was really a, and Maravich has sort of always been a guy who, incredibly skilled, wonderful to watch. But as far, you know, didn't really have a lot of, team success in the NBA. And part of that was a little bit of rosters, and I think part of that is just maybe he was a little bit of a hard guy to play with, and you know, and probably the lack of defense, probably, I would imagine, was also a significant issue for him.
Yeah, and in fact, he had his best seasons when the management specifically surrounded him with talented fits. So he either won or was close to the lead in the scoring title in the late 70s, and part of that was because the Jazz got a pass first point guard and a defensive oriented forward, small forward. So they kind of took pressure off Maravich and he could just score. But that wasn't management's initial idea. Their initial idea, and if you're talking about lowest point of the franchise, not necessarily a specific record so much as a free agent signing. And so the Jazz were trying to find another high scorer to pair with Maravich in the backcourt, hoping to kind of, you know, to equate to modern day, kind of a a late 70s Splash Brothers with two, you know, exciting high scoring guards that could lead the team. And so they signed Gale Goodrich, who was a 33-year-old coming off a 20-point season. He was two seasons, I believe, at this point, or three seasons removed from being a first-team All-NBA. But about a third of the way through the season, through his first year in New Orleans, he blew out his Achilles. And he was never really known as the fastest player, the quickest player, but he lost whatever was left, and he was kind of a shell of him, of his former self. But the biggest problem with that signing wasn't that Goodrich didn't pan out, but it was that they cost the Jazz two more first-round picks. And so ultimately, for Gale Goodrich, the Jazz lost out on Moses Malone and more famously Magic Johnson. And so with the potential of, you know, getting Magic Johnson and or Moses Malone, the Jazz end up with neither, but they do get a really old shooting guard named Stumpy out of the deal. So, you know, it's kind of a wash in the end.
There you go. Good old Stumpy. So was that pick later traded for Moses Malone? Was that how?
The pick was weird. It was they actually had picked Moses Malone, but if they, in order to get another pick to get Goodrich, they had to basically
was it like an expansion draft pick?
It was, yeah. Okay. It was actually the ABA draft. So it was complicated, but basically they had to choose either you keep Moses Malone or you let him go and get another first round pick so you could entice the Lakers to give up Gale Goodrich. And so they chose to give up the pick, to give up on Malone and get Goodrich.
Yeah, that was not a great decision. Yeah.
You know, anytime you can get Gale Goodrich, you have to do what you have to do, I guess. But.
Oh boy. This blew me away that Daryl Griffith in 1981 was the first Jazz player drafted with the Jazz's first round pick. The first seven were traded away. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we make, you know, NBA history kind of makes fun of Ted Stepien and the Cleveland Cavaliers for trading away all these first round picks. They actually create a rule that you can't trade consecutive first round picks. Well, that could have just as easily been, you know, whoever was running the New Orleans Jazz, because they traded seven straight number ones, giving up, you know, and they were terrible. So these are, we're talking top three, top five picks year after year after year. And in return, the Jazz are getting, you know, kind of veterans and, you know, players that just didn't turn around the franchise.
Yeah, not so much. So yeah, the longest suffering player was Aaron James, who played 356 games. Rich Kelly and Pete Maravich both came close. If you go by minutes, Maravich wins by a long shot. Rich Kelly's pain was spread out over two stints with the Jazz, both early and late. Aaron James, I picked also partially because he only ever played with the Jazz. He played for five seasons, so I feel like he never knew the promised land of playoffs with another team. So I feel like that gives extra, that's extra pain for me.
Yeah, no, they were really never that close to the playoffs. It's not like they missed by a hair or a game or two. And in 1976, they won 38 games. But they missed the playoffs by eight games that year. So they really never even got close. Although if you look at their best player near the end of the era, right near the end of the drought, they managed to trade for Adrian Dantley. They gave up Spencer Haywood. Spencer Haywood went to Los Angeles to the Lakers, and Adrian Dantley, who'd bounced around a couple with three or four teams in his first few seasons, ended up and becomes kind of the cornerstone of some pretty decent early 80s Jazz teams. And he played four seasons in the stretch and had 41 win shares, so he was easily far and away their best player, leading the league in scoring in 82 or 83. And so he's easily their best player.
Yeah
and he also actually leads them
no, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, he actually leads them to their we talked about breaking the playoff droughts. He actually helps break the playoff drought in 1984. For the Jazz, fortunately, the NBA expanded the playoffs, going from 12 teams to 16, so they had a better chance. But the Jazz also posted the franchise's first ever winning record after 10 years of finishing under 500. And Adrian Dantley was their star. He went for 31 points, 6 boards, and 4 assists per game. Had 14.6 win shares. And he was also helped out. They had added a few players. Daryl Griffith, who you mentioned, their 1981 first round pick, scored 20 points from at the shooting guard. And then Ricky Green, their point guard, handed out 9 assists per game. But one of their new new players, I guess, that would become kind of a cornerstone of some good Jazz teams later, they had a second year center, 7'4" Mark Eaton, who led the league in block shots, 4.3. Blocks per game. And so they kind of set some of the pieces in place with Adrian Dantley, trying to surround Adrian Dantley before they, of course, went in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah. So we are down to our last pick is the, again, the Golden State Warriors, 9 seasons in a row from 1978 to 1986. Yeah, it kind of all broke up after, you know, the Warriors, of course, won the championship in 75. 76, they were a 59-win team that was upset in the playoffs, but, you know, very near championship. They had some promising young players like Robert Parrish and Gus Williams from the Lakers.
Jamal Wilkes.
Yes, thank you, Jamal Wilkes. Yep. Geez. They went from being a team that like seemed like it could be have a chance to be a dynasty, or at least a really strong, have a really strong run, to a team that fell apart very quickly.
They did. They had, you know, as you said, won the title in 75, and they still had most of the pieces in place in the 77 season. And, you know, as we'll talk about in a little bit, they almost made the playoffs that year, but in 78, I should say, but they really had problems with, you know, they had a few bad trades, a few bad drafts, and it was the late 70s and early 80s. And so they had, some players, that had some bad drugs. And so the combination of drug problems and bad drafts and bad trades, which we've talked about, really hurts them. The first piece to fall was that Rick Barry, who was the star of those of the title winning team, signed as a free agent with Houston. Kind of shocked the franchise. The fans didn't expect it. It was kind of out of nowhere. And at the time, of course, players switched teams as compensation, like we talked about with Bill Walton. And John Lucas comes over to Golden State. But, you know, he's a good guard. But he was traded a few years later and then went to rehab. The worst deal that they made, though, was in 1980 when they traded Robert Parrish, who was – it's hard to think of Robert Parrish as a young center. But if you watch him from the late 70s, he still ran like a 40-year-old man. But they traded Robert Parrish and a 1980 first-round pick, which ended up being Kevin McHale, to Boston, and received the number one pick in 1980, Joe Barry Carroll, who every time I say that, I can't help but think of the nickname that he's always given, which was Joe Barely Cares.
Yeah, I think that was Bob Ryan nickname, I believe.
Is that who nicknamed him that? Yes. I couldn't remember who had done that. And so they have, you know, and actually he ends up not being horrible. Carroll has a couple decent seasons, but they try to build around him, and of course that fails. They traded for World Be Free, and also traded for Bernard King. He played for them for a part of a season, I believe, and then went to Michael. They traded him to the Knicks for Michael Ray Richardson, who was banned from the leagues for drugs. So they had a myriad of problems, but they had probably two low points in both 79-80 and 84-85. They had really bad seasons. In 79-80, I thought it was interesting. The team fired Al Attles, who'd been the coach of their championship team. They fired him midway through the season. Their top players were Robert Parrish and a guy named Sonny Parker, whose son Jabari plays for the Bucks now. And so with those two as their star players, they went 24-58. And then a few years later, in 84-85, they only won 22 games. And their top player then was Purvis Short, who was kind of a small forward. He's actually listed in Basketball Reference as a shooting guard, small forward, power forward.
So he could do a little bit of everything, and he added here. He scored 28 points a game that season, but didn't make the All-Star team. And actually, again, thanks to Basketball Reference, only two players have scored more points in a season without making the All-Star team that year. One was World B. Free, and the other was surprisingly Dominique Wilkins. So both averaged, around 28 points a game, and none of them made the All-Star team.
That's interesting. Dominique is a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too. And it's not that he missed many games or anything. He just, didn't make the All-Star team that season. So, several low points in this run for the Warriors. They almost made the playoffs in the first year of the drought, 1977-78, but they finished a game out. In 1982, they won 45 games, but were seventh in the West. And at the time, the NBA only took six teams from each conference, and they finished a game out again. So unlike some of these teams, they actually were very close, within a game or two of making the playoffs. Both their longest suffering and best player is the same person. It's Purvis Short, who I mentioned, the shooting guard / power forward of the team. He played 580 games, and he was easily their best player. He had basically 40 win shares in that stretch, and so he's easily their best player in these very kind of mediocre teams.
Yeah. It's interesting how the Warriors were. This is definitely by far, I think, the best of these teams that we've talked about. Like, they actually had, some decent, they had a couple of like decent years where they just didn't happen to make the playoffs, but they were less of a disaster, I think, than most of these other runs that we were talking about. It was more just kind of like an unlucky stretch of like, oh, they just didn't happen to make it, but they definitely could have made it twice, and they would have only had like a 3 or 4 year drought, which is fairly normal, obviously, in basketball history.
Well, and it's they suffer kind of in this short window between the NBA expanding after the ABA merger and but the playoffs not expanding, and so the playoffs was only 12, only included 12 teams until 84. And so they finished, it was the 13th or 14th best team in the league, or at least the seventh best in the West a couple of times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when they do finally make the playoffs, when they break their streak, the playoffs are expanded to 16 teams, and they finished tied for sixth in the West. And in fact, in their first year in the playoffs, they even won a playoff series. They beat the Utah Jazz that year with John Stockton and Karl Malone in their second season together. Stockton and Malone made the playoffs in both of their first two seasons and lost both times in the first round. So they didn't. We think of Malone and Stockton as kind of leading teams to the conference finals, or at least out of the first round. Well, their first 2 years they lost, and including breaking the drought of this Warriors team. And that Warriors team had an interesting lineup. They had George Karl, who was in his first year with the team, though he didn't make it through the entire second season. And they had a mishmash of players there. They had Joe Barry Carroll at center, who we talked about earlier as the number one pick in 1980. And they also had point guard Sleepy Floyd and second year forward guard Chris Mullin. And so you can kind of see there the beginnings of those, run TMC teams. The teams would kind of bring the Warriors at least some short-term success. They were in place by the mid to late 80s, and with Chris Mullin coming, the kind of that era is beginning.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Only had two All-Stars in this stretch, Rick Barry and Bernard King. So, they did have some good players, but of course most of those players didn't last for very long, which was kind of the part of the problem of for them in this run. Other than Purvis, though.
Yes, other than Purvis Short, the rest of it was a revolving door. I mean, if you look at their second best player in the era, it's probably Robert Parrish, and he was only there for 2.5 seasons. So, right. they had it was a revolving door there, and but they were never horrible. They just were kind of middling and not quite good enough to make the smaller playoff field.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, I will quickly go through the other teams' longest playoff drought, because I thought that was interesting. With eight are the Wizards from, or the then Bullets from 89 to 96, the Nuggets from 96 to 03, the Grizzlies from 96 to 03, and the Hawks from 2000 to 07. The Cavs, having seven season gaps, are the Cavs from 99 to 2005, the Knicks from 1960 to 66, the Sonics from 68 to 74, the Bucks from 92 to 98, and the 76ers from 92 to 98. I thought it was interesting that the Bucks and 76ers had the exact same one, since I've always thought of them as having very similar, like, windows for in the 80s and early 90s, for the fact that they had this exact same stretch of missing the playoffs. I thought it was interesting.
That is interesting.
The Pistons, having six, the Pistons have had six twice, currently from 2010 to 15, so it could reach seven, and also from 78 to 83. The Bulls from 99 to 2004, the Celtics from 96 to 2001, the Trailblazers from 71 to 76. It was their expansion seasons. They, of course, would win the championship the next year. Having five are the Suns, who have done it twice. A current streak from 2011-15 could obviously reach six. 71-75. The Nets from 87-91 and 2008-2012. The Bobcats from 2005 to 2009. The Rockets from 70-74, the Pacers from 82-86, those sad years for you. The Raptors from 09 to 2013, and then with four are the first version of the Hornets from 89 to 92, the Magic from 90-93. They could tie that if they miss the playoffs this year. And the Heat from 89 to 91. The Lakers are currently on a two-game playoff drought streak, which they also had from 75 to 76. It will very likely be a three-season streak at the end of this season. And the Spurs have never missed the playoffs more than one season in a row, which is pretty amazing.
That's amazing.
So, Adam, why don't you let everyone know where they can find you on Twitter, and anything else you want to tell them about yourself?
You can find me on Twitter at Adam Cribbley, AdamCribblez.
And everyone should follow Adam. He's a great he's a great basketball follow and a great guy. I appreciate you very much for filling in for Rich. I know he appreciates it as well while he gets some stuff going. But everyone. Thanks for checking us out. You can find us on Twitter at Over and Back NBA, also on Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Find us at heartbrokenproxism.com. We are part of the HB family of podcasts. You can find both our podcast and the HB Network podcast on iTunes. If you would leave us a rating and review, we would greatly appreciate it. And until next time, thanks everyone for listening. We're back again soon.